Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's Tuesday Noon Academy. I'm Zandy Springs, a third-year student in the Public Events and Community Programs Events Assistant. Now I'd like to introduce today's speaker, Jackie Warnemont, who is a Scripps College Assistant Professor of English. Professor Warnemont is affiliated with the Intercollegiate Media Studies and the Science, Technology, and Society programs of the Claremont Colleges, as well as the Gender and Women's Studies program at Scripps, and teaches on topics related to early modern literature, digital humanities, the history of science, and possible worlds theory. She received her PhD and MA in English Literature from Brown University and her BA in English from the University of Iowa, where she also studied molecular biology. She first delved into digital humanities at the Brown University Women's Writers Project, where she began as an encoder and later worked as the project manager and text-based editor. She was also a member of the Scholarly Technology Group at Brown and worked on the Modernist Journals Project. Prior to Scripps, she taught at Harvey Mudd College as a fellow and visiting assistant professor. Her current research focuses on relationships between early modern poetry and mathematics and on the practical and theoretical issues around digital archives. Please join me in welcoming Professor Jackie Warnemont.
Thank you for the lovely introduction. Hi, everybody. I generally try not to start talks with caveats, but I will say that my laptop is with the Philadelphia TSA right now because I left it there on Saturday when I went through security. So this talk has a slightly different form and perhaps a little more informal aspect than it would have had otherwise. I'm happy to say that the TSA found my laptop and it will be back here on Friday. We will be reunited. So what I'm going to talk about today is something that I've been calling the Poem Algo Object Project, which is a clumsy name. It will surely need something better. But it's a project that I did over the course of last summer with a Scripps student whose name is Beatrice Maldonado, who would be here except that she's in Spain doing awesome study abroad things. And we did this work with one of the Mellon undergraduate research in the humanities grants. So it was sort of a very bounded and exploratory project. And I'll sort of point to the ways in which I see it fitting into some bigger things, but also talk a little bit about the roadblocks that we ran into and how I think they're kind of illuminating. All right, so big data is a big keyword right now in the academy and in popular culture. People know more about metadata, that is data about data, in the wake of the NSA spying than they ever cared to know before, and I suspect more than they would care to know in the future. The quantified self movement has taken, in the words of its founder, Gary Wolf, the dictum to know thyself out of the messy terrain of words and into what seems to be the relatively clarifying space of numbers. And as someone who works on numbers and words together, I find this sort of popular culture movement really quite interesting. Now, in popular conception, there is a sort of sense that the humanities are in many ways late to the digital game. And in some respects, this is true. The incorporation of large-scale data visualizations, massive and open data registries, and interpretive or visualizing technologies like GIS have long been underway in the sciences. However, from the work in book history to abstract art to quote-unquote traditional humanities, we've long been asking questions about the relationships of form, material, and content to knowledge, ethics, and aesthetics. And while DH, that is digital humanities, and digital studies are a relatively new set of fields, questions about the value of technology to humanistic inquiry aren't new at all. They date back at least to Plato's concern with the value of poetry, I would argue. And Western society has never seen a moment when our epistemological tools, humanistic, philosophic, or scientific, were of just one kind, and the situation is no different today. So we see now, in the Chronicle of Higher Education, for example, up there on the left-hand side, an entire series on big data in the humanities, of the sort that's suggested by Lev Manovich's play on the soap opera, Days of Our Lives. He has instead here, The Algorithms of Our Lives, in which he details the social networking mapping that he and his colleagues have been doing. And what they've been looking at are tweets and other kinds of social network discourse and sort of mapping according to geographic region as a kind of picture of our everyday experience in social media. You also have something like the Stanford Republic of Letters, which is this, this is a screenshot from their project is huge. The website's really worth taking some time to look at. But in the Stanford Republic of Letter project, a team of scholars is working to map what is perhaps the most robust period of epistolary exchange in the Western literary tradition. And here, this screenshot is of Voltaire's Places of Publication, and they have they've developed a really lovely interface for these. They're leveraging a whole bunch of data along with a relatively large text collection. And then they have these visualizations. And here what you have are not only in yellow Voltaire's actual places of publication, but also his fictional places of publication, places that he said or other people has said that he published his work, in which there doesn't seem to have actually been the case. So one of the things that projects like this are able to do is to map not only sort of real histories, including literary histories, but also sort of imagined histories. We also have work like that of Franco Moretti, Ted Underwood, and Matt Jockers, considering how large-scale data analysis can help us refigure the stories we tell about literary history. And in their work, we see an interest to shift old received narratives in order to account for the life cycle, quite literally in Moretti's work, of the novel, or trends in certain genre formations over time. And what you have here is a scatter plot of social restraint field. So it's a kind of linguistic analysis of a large corpus of texts, over 3,000 texts. And what they're trying to do is map over time how often the discourse of social restraint comes up. And the idea here is that they're able to visualize a very tight clustering that happens around the 1880s. And for someone like Franco Moretti, who wrote the Atlas of the European Novel and a number of other texts, what he's been interested to do is to say, the stories that we told about how literary genres came to be, what was popular, how long particular forms of the novel lasted, are completely wrong. What he argues his big data analysis is able to do is to say, actually, popular forms map onto the lifetimes of people, generations of people. So generations of readers is exactly how we see the turnover in popular forms, which creates a literary history that actually operates in about 80-year chunks rather than these sort of long scales that we tend to think of. Now, while this work is very often done at a large scale and using metadata fields or looking at the collected internal features of large texts, often in the thousands or more, it can also produce really interesting analysis at smaller levels. And this here is an example of topic modeling in archaeological inscriptions, right? So if you think about the kinds of things that you might see etched in stone in archaeological monuments, things like that, those inscriptions are, in part because of their media, quite short, but they're often also quite fragmented, right? Because stones tend to be broken, tablets lose bits, et cetera. So we have people using these very same tools on much smaller scales. And what someone like Sean Graham is doing here, he's known as the electronic archaeologist, which I think is kind of cool, is creating a visualization developed out of topic maps. So he's looking for conceptual clusters in inscriptions, and he's gathering large sets of those inscriptions in order to do something like this. Now, as someone who thinks about the persuasive and knowledge-making power of figures alongside words, I'm really interested in the aesthetics of visualizations that often go along with big data work. This derives in part from my commitment to thinking about literary analysis as a creative effort, one that participates as much in the tradition of poesis, that is, of making, as it does in exegesis or explaining. Now, this interest in making is part of another trend in digital humanities, which is to think about what they call critical making. That is a kind of hybrid practice that makes in order to understand and offer critique. Now, in critical making, one is building not simply to create a product, but as a way of developing embodied knowledge and experience when working with certain media. Areas like critical code studies, maker and hacker spaces, and performance art are all sort of part of this tradition. I think of them as kind of adjoining practices in some ways. But I would also argue that the older and more traditionally scholarly endeavor of making a critical edition, that is, you know, collating particular instances of Lear, Shakespeare's King Lear, for example, along with editorial annotations, et cetera, that we might think of that also as a kind of critical making. So in addition to thinking about the big data move, I've been looking at tactile or material poetry a lot. So there's sort of the big data trend in both popular culture and digital humanities, but then also this idea of tactile poetry. And here this is, Giles Lane is working with a group in the UK. If you can see this, it's like a seashell shape, right? And it's like a charm that they produced. But this charm was produced out of data that they captured as a kind of data tracking experiment of their daily lives. So they were getting things like heart rate, movement, other kinds of quantitative data, and they were aggregating it and then translating it into physical forms and then thinking about that as kind of wearable art. And they're interested in what happens when you wear your data, which I think is a sort of interesting question. It might also include things like Jim Rosenberg's hypertext poetry, language and word art, or like those large physical installations. And then a really quite popular field right now in literary studies, which is electronic or e-literature. So as well as things that are apparently less wordy, like this tactile poetry, I've also been thinking about things that sort of take words and translate them into data structures. So this is Eraldi Tarone's mapping of the entire Shakespeare corpus through the lens of his reading of Antony and Cleopatra. And this is actually produced using 3D printing. What you can't see up here is that this is a richly textured and 3D object. It has some really amazing different colors and different surfaces on it. And here what he's done is used line length and depth to express things like genre and length of text. And then the colors are expressing something a bit more interpretive. Particularly he's interested in a couple of rubrics that he set up around Cleopatra and her depiction in that text, around emotional strength, power, tone, etc. You also get things like Kate McLean's sensory maps. She's a visual artist working on the East Coast, and she's leveraging 3D printing technology to recreate what she describes as experiential maps of places. And in this particular case, she's mapping emotion against time in space. This was her experience of a particular area on the East Coast. But she also has 3D instances of sensory maps of things like the smells of London. So she decides the X and Y axes are entirely subjective. She's created them herself. But then she, you know, keeps these journals where she's writing them down in a text, mapping them over time, and then creating these 3D objects out of them. So the summer project that Bea and I undertook with that Mellon undergraduate research grant was inspired by all of this work and then informed by what's been called reading algorithmically in the literary tradition. Now, algorithmic reading, something that both Jamie Sky Bianco and people like Stephen Ramsey have been talking about, is a relatively new subset of the sort of digital humanities approach to literary studies. And, you know, if we think of an algorithm as a set of instructions for calculations, it need not be expressed in mathematical language, although I'm particularly interested in instances where it is. You can state an algorithm as in prose or as a kind of flow chart of decisions. It's a set of processing instructions in many ways. And I'm particularly interested, as I said, in instances where we're kind of mathematizing or dataizing the words so that we are transforming them not simply into a set of kind of analytic instructions, but into a set of numerical representations as well. Now, when someone like Jamie Sky Bianco is talking about this, she's talking about computationally derived critical and artistic practice. So she's leveraging algorithmic reading as a kind of live performance of criticism so that the computer is generating it as a particular user comes to it. Ramsey's version of algorithmic criticism is a little bit different. It's imagined as a natural evolution of text analysis, that is a tradition within literary studies that focuses on questions of style and author attribution, a very traditional area of literary studies. And early literary text analysis was rooted in a kind of appeal to a scientific approach. That is, how can we answer literary historical questions of the kind, did Shakespeare write X? Or who wrote this poem for which we have no attribution? That you could take a kind of scientific approach to developing sure answers to the questions about both authorship and style that largely had been answered impressionistically up to that point. And in this way, text analysis shared a great deal with computational linguistics. They were essentially attempting to model language behavior. Now, if Ramsey notes that text analysis, in order to participate in literary critical endeavor in some way beyond fact-checking, has to generate further evidence, that is, he's thinking about this computational approach not as answering questions, but instead as generating more questions, right? That there's a kind of generative criticism that he's interested in developing. He's suggesting that instead the answers are not definitive, but suggestive of larger arguments, schemes, or patterns. So we're looking then, I think if we take a kind of hybrid of all of these, at a way of making our generative, this is what Bea and I were trying to do, making our generative critique physical. We wanted to make a physical object. In essence, we were wondering what would happen to our sense of what poetry is and what it means if it underwent transformations from a textual object to a calculated representation to a physical object. I wanted to know if poetry was something different in words and numbers and kind of like the rough equivalent of a Nerf football. I actually fantasized quite a lot about throwing a poem across the room at a person, but that might just be me. I wanted to know, would we think differently about the status of a poem, its formidable interpretive demands, or its emotional content, if it was suddenly something that we could play with as if it were a child's toy? And would we be able to talk about interpretation differently if we were literally holding an interpretation in our hands? And we sincerely wondered, would that interpretation mean anything to the person who was holding it, right? So there's not only the question of how might we sort of manifest our interpretations, but would anyone be able to get that interpretation? And did it matter? We weren't necessarily sure. And I think that's one of the ways in which this project was sort of working at that space in between poesis making and exegesis or explaining, right? Was our objective to explain the poem? I think not, but you know, wondering whether or not there were explanatory qualities to a physical object, and whether or not those could sort of exist with a more impressionistic aesthetic representation in interesting ways was something that we wanted to take a look at. I also, wanted to know if we could use big data tools to think about much, much smaller volumes of data. That is, a poem, perhaps a set of 5 or even 10, which hardly lives up to the big data threshold, or at least I thought that was the case. One of the things that I'm going to show you is the way in which our tiny little 1 minute of data turned into something so big that it broke the computer, which was a surprise to me and to Sam, who helped us. So Bea and I started out with reading a lot of it. She and I selected a set of poems from each of the last 5 centuries, and she performed a number of readings on them, first essentially getting familiar with the poems and their ideas, then detailing her own close readings. And we spent a good deal of time both thinking and talking about what we meant by performing analysis. So was it simply our objective to communicate our analysis of the poem, or did we want to think about it in this more performative, creative, perhaps poetic way? And it was about this time that we ran into our first roadblock. I had made provisions for some time on a 3D printer in town, and we had been, along with our reading and talking, busy learning how to use that 3D printer. I had actually been at the University of Victoria's Digital Humanities Summer Institute the summer before and built my own 3D printer, which is awesome, and then made some stuff with it. And so I had felt relatively confident that we were going to be able to do this with an established 3D printer, but we did need to learn some of the software in order to do that. Unfortunately for us, time on that 3D printer never materialized. So we had to transition to thinking about a different output. And we explored several online options. Shapeways is a great resource for on-demand 3D printing. There's quite a number of companies that you can sort of send a file to and get something printed and then sent back to you. But there are both costs and time expenditures involved in that. So what we had to do was then transition from what we were going to do on the particular 3D printer here in town to something, a kind of file that the Shapeways folks could handle, and a kind of media selection that is the material that it would actually be printed in that they could do. So we also had to, because we knew we weren't going to have any, we were going to be paying for it, rather than having this kind of exploratory time on a local printer, we needed to tighten our scope even further. So we picked just one poem. And we also needed to learn how to get that poem from its textual instance, as I said, into a format that Shapeways accepted. And the reason that I have this slide up here is that this is one of the things that we were sort of playing around with. This is simply an Excel graph of one of our sort of interpretive efforts. Here we have three different axes, including line length, location of word, and then the type of word, noun, adjective, et cetera, that was on a particular line of a poem. And we were playing around with sort of graphing it. And what we had hoped our next step would be was to take something like a graph like this, which is what I think of as a more traditional numerical representation, and turn it into a 3D object. The roadblock with the 3D printer meant that we had to sort of back away from this work that we had done and go into something else, because this wasn't going to work for sending a file to Shapeways. So I'm going to play for you the poem that we selected.
Gone, I say, and walk from church, refusing the stiff procession to the grave, letting the dead ride alone in reverse. It is June. I'm tired of being brave. We drive to the Cape. I cultivate myself, a blushing hermit in the sun, where the sea swings in like an iron gate, and I turn to you and am bright and young. My love, the wind falls in like stones from a white mountain, and where we touch, we are twice marked and twice alone. Men kill for this. For as much. And what would the dead say? What defiles their calm eyes and their loose brows? Not this, for through their tiny smiles they mutter, live now, live now.
So that poem is Anne Sexton's The Truth That the Dead Know, and we decided that that would be our target text, in part because Bea was interested in it, but also because we had a relatively clean, easy, manipulable audio file of it. And our task at this point was then to figure out how we might get this poem literally into shape. I guess maybe not literally, it might be more so to speak, but how we would get it into some kind of shape. And we were inspired by Amanda Gossi's Sound Bites experiment. One of the things that was really great about this is that it was open source and we had complete access to the code for our own manipulation. One of my favorite things in the sort of DH and Maker communities right now is that things are sort of available on GitHub or other places where you can download them and then use them, as long as you're giving credit to the person who originally developed them. And what she had done was to make 3D prints that you could essentially play as records. And there are instances of this on much larger scales. There's a street in China, for example, or a road, where when you drive over it, your tires act as the record needle, essentially, and it plays a tune. And you've got a similar sort of thing going on here. So she has a small audio file that she's printed out on a 3D printer at home, a low-tech 3D printer. And if you run a credit card or some other stiff card across this, it will play the song back for you. And so Bea and I were sort of interested in thinking about what it would mean to allow or to create an object that we could both hold in our hands, but that could literally perform in ways that we had not previously imagined when we started the project, so that you could play Sexton's poem even as you were holding it. And we were able to get the code that that Gossi used for this. This is just a screenshot of the essentially the instructions that would tell the computer how to go from our sound file into something like a basic text file. And this is We sort of messed around with this. We went to Sam Combe at the library and said, please help us and make sure that we're doing these things sanely. And happily, we ended up with an amazing output. It worked. Sort of. This is a screen capture of just one part of the text file. It's several hundred pages long, and it stopped. We never got to complete it. That sound clip that I played for you was, as I said, our target text. It's a one-minute sound clip. When I think about big data, I don't think about 1 minute as particularly big data. But we ran this on every computer that Sam had access to at the library, and it broke every processor there was. So we couldn't complete it. This was our second major roadblock. The thing that we thought we were going to be able to do to put into a file that we could send to Shapeways, we simply couldn't. And part of this was sort of our own experimental bumbling in some ways. Knowing that the soundbite program that Gassi had written essentially mapped the highs and lows of a sound file, didn't necessarily translate into us in our brains into an enormous numerical record. We didn't foresee that. And I certainly didn't think that the record was going to be so complicated that the processors would just stop working. We could have left them running all night. I don't think it would have made any difference. It just shut everything down. So this is sort of the instance where I think of our very small data having suddenly become big enough data that a relatively robust computing setup could not handle it. We would have had to go to something more complicated. I think we also could have probably written a much better program in order to translate our data, right? If we had had a better sense of our data ahead of time. I think this is one of the interesting things about this experiment for me is that we thought, yes, we're going to try this, and we will jump feet first in, and we don't necessarily know what we're doing. And then we learned just how complicated some of those data metrics can in fact be. Because if you look at this poem on a page, right, it's like 15 lines, and then the 1 minute, it seems like that ought to be relatively easy. So we were halfway through, more than two-thirds of the way through the summer at this point, and bam, I said, oh, well, so failure one, failure two, what shall we do now? And we turned to a much lower tech option, which was the analog technology of Legos. and this actually, it turned out okay. I think as a short-term experiment, it was a way to get around issues around processing. It was a way to get around issues of our own sort of lack of expertise in this respect. And what Bea did was to create her final project. She wanted to make sure she had something for the research symposium, et cetera. She chose a different poem. This one is Two Paths by Julia Caroline Ripley Dorr. It was a poem that she felt particularly connected to after that first set of reading that we did. And she decided that she was going to take our process first of sort of basic reading, then close reading, then a kind of emotional mapping based on those sensory maps that I showed you a little bit earlier, and create a 3D model of her reading of Two Paths out of Legos. And so she's mapped this, she's, an X and a Y axes. She was interested in temporal signifiers in the poem, so things that happened in the past are over here on the left side. Any words that sort of indicated futurity or hopefulness are over there on the right side. The height or depth, as it is from this perspective, of the various Lego pieces are an indicator of Bea's own interpretation of the degree of hopefulness or fearfulness that was expressed in particular terms. So for her, this was a way of performing an interpretation in a physical format, very different from what we had first imagined. We spent some time talking about whether or not this means for anybody who's looking at it, and she presented it at both the Undergraduate Research Symposium, but then also at the Southern California Undergraduate Research Showcase. And she got some really interesting feedback. She has to do a lot of explanatory work in order to make this go in some ways, right? And it doesn't have the kind of pick it up and throw it quality that we wanted out of something more like those sensory maps. And yet for her, it gave her a very different sense of what close reading could do for her, what performing analysis meant, right? She had previously, to this point, really been sort of restricted to the write-a-paper prose mode, and she found this as a kind of exegetical exercise really interesting and very different. She also felt like this gave her greater clarity on just how interpretive interpretation is, right? Rather than it being something that clearly delineates what a poem means, it, for her, sort of brought to the fore the kind of generative and poetic quality of interpretation or literary analysis. So that's the extent of what I have to show you today. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have about the process, et cetera. Right now, the poem Algo Object exists sort of as a self-contained summer adventure. I still have to figure out. I desperately want to be able to throw a Shakespeare sonnet at someone. I really, really do. And then I want to think critically about what that means. But first, I want to throw it. So at some point, that sort of work will go forward. But I think until I can get some pretty stable access to a 3D printer and things like that, it'll have to hang out for a little while. So thanks for coming. I mean, I think there are a couple of different things. I think, you know, there are ways in which the intermediary stage, the sort of algorithmic stage of this process, is already what people who are doing the kind of algorithmic criticism are doing. And I think, you know, the sense that there might be new questions generated by looking at large corpora of poetry is quite interesting. I think, you know, some of the stylistic questions, there's been some really interesting work lately on gendered language and authors and their gender in this sort of large scale, which I think has the potential to maybe sort of reify our old assumptions about things or maybe some old saws, but I think it might also break them apart, demonstrating that there's in fact much more fluidity between genders and genres than people had previously thought. In terms of moving from the sort of algorithmic into the object, into a kind of tactile engagement with criticism, I think it offers a way of demystifying critique, right? I mean, I think poetry is already sometimes mystifying for students. I think literary analysis is maybe doubly so. And I think there's a way in which it can make... I don't know that I want to say that it's accessible, but playful is perhaps, right? If you can throw the sonnet at me, that there's some play in there, right? But I think one of the things that can be quite hard to do is to think about where the serious intellectual work of play is, right? And you can't do that until you can start to play, and then you can start to think about the serious intellectual work of play. So, you know, I mean, I think making some of those boundaries a little bit more porous would be quite interesting. I also, as someone who's interested in form, think that one of the great things that translations between forms allows is greater precision about what the original form did, right? So greater precision of my own sense of how words make meaning on a page, as opposed to what happens when they become numerical representations or they become physical representations. So I think there might be really interesting insights for the field at large about form and also media and modes. Yeah?
I was just you know, thinking about when you mentioned that she learned about the, you know, this, essentially the interpretiveness of interpretation. And I'm wondering, have these tools been used to compare different people's interpretations of the same piece? And even similarly, maybe a single person's interpretation of a piece written in different languages?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, there aren't a lot of people that I know of who are taking data visualizations and using them comparatively to one another. Yep. One of the things that I think has been happening in the big data move is a sense, and this is sort of what Ramsey is pointing to, a sense that this is going to get us greater accuracy. Franco Moretti, for example, when he talks about it, is absolutely all about the greater precision now. Of like, he thinks he's telling the truth about literary history, and I would depart significantly from that. You know, and he thinks he's upended hundreds of years of literary scholarship in one fell swoop, which is awesome for him, but doesn't really admit the kind of comparative analysis that you're talking about. I think one of the things that would be really interesting is to say, all right, so if we can actually take a close reading and make it visual, then the what does a close reading look like, right, becomes very different. And you could say, you know, when you get this in discussion, right, you get this in a good seminar, oh, you know, I understood the rain there to operate in this way. Oh, really? I understood it this way. So you can get that in dialogue. It's not as if you can't get it, but I think there's something that happens when you can see it. I think certain things are occluded, but certain things are brought to the fore. And one of the things that might be brought to the fore is that kind of variation. But you might also see a great deal of similarity, right? What are the core things that people seem to agree on when they're talking about interpretation? Is that cultural? Is that received? Is that there? You know, so that it would allow people to ask those kinds of questions, but that hasn't really been done yet. Yeah, Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
But no words to sort of indicate what those pluses and minuses meant. And so somehow in a lot of the images that you showed us, there seemed to be a prohibition of using text.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've taken some text and now I have a seashell, there's no text there. I have this thing, you know, the regular mm-hmm. no text at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder though, when you kind of think about conveying meaning, if some sort of combination of the textual and the mathematized would actually more of what you're trying to do there, you know, past, future, or, you know, because those words past, future might not have been in the poem, so it's not like you're
yeah, they're not
cheating
yeah.
by sharing what's in the poem. So I think there's a lot more you could do with this to think about conveying meaning in a way that's even more mathematical in the sense that you label your axes. You know, I mean,
for sure.
You know, in a funny way, but it's interesting.
Yeah. You know, so Bea and I talked about this at great length because she sort of went away and built this and then came back to me and I said, I have no idea what that, I don't know what that means. And she was like, that's the point. And I was like, okay. You know, so for her, she did want to obfuscate linguistic meaning in that way, right? She didn't want to produce something that seemed to transparently mean. And for her, that was about forcing a dialogue between in this case, the artist interpreter and its audience. It's a choice, right? I actually think it makes the visualization, if we think about it as a kind of visualization rather than just a kind of physical manifestation, really, really hard to engage with, right? Like it might be, like in the case of this, like really aesthetically pleasing, like, ooh, neat, right? This, in its native environment, comes with a whole bunch of text that sort of explicates how it works, right? And there are, in fact, you know, all manner of little data points underneath it in the legend that help you make sense of it. She didn't want to do that. And I think, for me, the question, if we're talking about data visualization and I want it to mean in a book, on a website, I've got to give that kind of information. If I want to be able to throw Sonnet 14 across the room, I can't put a legend with it, right? And so it seems like those are two maybe slightly different versions of visualizing information. Yeah.
Interesting, you have the similarity in art, you call symbolism as in art, and looking at abstract art too, mm-hmm. there's no legend mm-hmm. to what we're looking at. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's like creating new symbols, new understanding. You may learn about it, the more you learn about lepro, the more you understand about
Well, I think that's where one would have to think very hard about whether or not, as in the case of this one is themselves an artist. This person is a graphic designer. And they've taken inspiration from a text in order to create something new. Or if one is trying to communicate something about your quote-unquote target text. Because it seems to me those are two totally different objectives, right? And given that they're different objectives, they have different needs. I think, you know, insofar as Bea and I were talking about offering an interpretation of a poem, I think we would probably have to unpack what it means to offer an interpretation, right? Can that simply reside as a kind of creative act? Yeah, it can. But does it need to mean in some way? If so, then I think, as Ray is suggesting, you need some more information. Right.
And so it's easier to throw if those weren't there.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Because it's not, then you have an object you could throw.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I would push back to her and say, well, if you're really not going to do that, then you don't need those multiple lines because it's already conveyed by the
app. Right, right.
And the fact that we do left or right and we can develop that.
Right. Well, and you could also say, right, like, you don't need the axes. Like, if you want something to throw, get rid of the axes altogether. You know they're there. I mean, there is a kind of quadrant structure to it. Like, take it the whole way. Let it go. Yeah.
So it seems to me if you wanted to throw a poem at somebody, you could print it out,
mm-hmm.
scrunch up a piece of paper,
yep.
and throw that.
You sure can.
So I'm not really sure what you mean by turning a poem into an object. And I guess I'm wondering in all of this, not your project so much as the ones that you're the larger field.
Mm-hmm.
What is at stake? What are we saying objects and images? I mean, there seems to be a lot of mileage that the digital humanities is getting by using images and objects that clearly they think they're not going to get from other forms of creativity. So if you were to say, well, I have this poem and I'd like to turn it into an interpretive dance,
mm-hmm.
and I'd like to get funding for it to work with my professor to do this over the course of the summer,
mm-hmm.
we would be jailed. First of all, you wouldn't get the funding
mm-hmm.
because it wouldn't have digital humanities attached to it.
Sure.
And it wouldn't be about a visual object, image, and all this kind
mm-hmm.
of stuff. So it seems there's a lot going on with how you sort of the clutch of the visual and the art object. And I'm really glad you said that about, you know, graphic designer. So I have sort of questions about what these people are doing by making images, or what they think they're doing, or what they want us to do.
Right.
It seems to me, you know, obviously this is something I'm super interested in. It's something that's creeping into art history through business schools.
Yeah.
Curatorial projects that are mapping
mm-hmm.
stories in ways that actually don't tell us much about the stuff, but
mm-hmm.
we do have nice pictures at the entrance to the Roman exhibitions. And that I'm sort of already kind of nervous about.
Sure.
So I'm wondering, in a world where there are people trained in interpreting images, making objects, interpreting objects, why are they not involved in this stuff? And why are so many people doing things with images instead of interpretive dances?
Well, I think there are many important things that you raise in there, right? I think the question, right, about interpretive dance in some way, I think is, I think part of what that points to is a lack of professional regard for playful, embodied exploration of intellectual ideas, right? And I think one of the things that's nice about thinking about digital humanities and maybe even some strains of media studies is that there's a way in, right? Because people aren't going to giggle, right? So there's an opportunity there. So I think there's a kind of that's there. And I mean, I would say you ought to be able to get a grant in order to do an interpretive dance myself. But I think there's also a certain interest in and a certain cachet for the scientific approaches to the things that seemed fuzzy, right? So, you know, I don't care about, and I find incredibly annoying, the crisis in the humanities conversation. It makes me insane. at the same time, I think there is a way in which part of the reason that DH has become popular is because it appears to give greater popular currency to the things that humanists do, right? And I think that's problematic, I think that often in the instances where people are simply leveraging the digital in order to seem more certain or more right or more scientific, it's deeply problematic. You know, in an instance where you're talking about something like the enormous popularity right now of geospatial mapping, right, of figural representations of large sets of data, I think there's a real anxiety, both in popular culture, but also in the academy, especially where people are interested in archival work, around the invisibility of their assets, right? You know, people talk about the data deluge, only that's not even remotely new, right? So the problem of how do you daylight an archival collection, and this is something, you know, I mean, when we did the Creating Archives class with the Denison, one of the great benefits was that people could now see things that were in the collection. And I think that seeing things in the collection has often come to be done in a very shorthand way with things like visualizations. And my first critique, the Stanford Republic of Letters project is 5 or 6 years old now. Initially, it was just this really sexy map, and I was deeply angry at it, right? Because everyone was showing it, including me, because it was sexy. People go, ooh, you know, it was like a black background and like neon red and orange, you know, showing the transmission of letters. So it was using the metadata, but you couldn't get anywhere else with it. So it was like, oh, neat, I have a picture of the Republic of Letters, now what? You know, I think that project has become more nuanced. You can actually get into the collection. You can actually see the archival materials. I'm really interested in the problem of the digital surrogate standing in for objects in archives, as if that was a transparent translation across media. You know, so I think there's some desire to make things that seem boring and old or out of date sexy, right? So I think there's a lot of that there. I think there's a legitimate sense that computational technologies can do something that we couldn't do before. And I'm deeply suspicious of that claim, right? This idea that we can suddenly know everything or suddenly survey all of the texts or suddenly answer the questions that we couldn't answer, I'm really quite suspicious of it. But I think that's what a lot of what DH trades on. I'm particularly interested in sort of where the media studies traditions, including the performing traditions, come to converge with something like the digital things, which is why I like this idea of small data and performance rather than big data and certainty. But I would say that I'm in a minority in the field there. You know, and there's a lot of money to be had right now, right? And so, you know, I mean, one of the things that we see are people sort of opportunistically saying, oh, I'm going to do this using the digital, without a very nuanced sense of how many digitals there might be, what it would mean to do that, et cetera. So I think, you know, some of it's opportunistic, some of it's genuine, some of it's inflected towards science studies. I like the space that's more in the kind of performative media translation kind of space. So does that get at your question? I think there's a lot of things going on. Yeah. When I think there are more and more people who are trying to find those avenues, right? I think one of the things that happened is when digital humanities sort of started as sort of like computational English, essentially, right? It was housed in a very specific discipline. So you have people who are doing things like sound studies, various kinds of digital performative studies, et cetera, who are starting to make those inroads. And I think one of the big questions is that still DH? Or is this something new? Or is this simply other disciplines, you know, merging together? And I think, honestly, part of the problem is that it takes an incredible amount of time to make those connections, right? So to find those people and then and discover that work, right? Because I'm trained as a 17th century British literature person, right? And so it takes a very one has to think very outwardly in order to find those people to do those things with. And there are some opportunities for that, but I would say not nearly enough. Also, there's not a lot of academic credit given for that, right? So, well, interestingly, you can get the funding, right? But like even for major DH projects, that doesn't count for tenure at almost everywhere, right? So every DH scholar that I've ever known has said, write a monograph and do your work on top, you know, and so there's already a kind of doubling of the work. So I think partly it's just time. But there should be more connections. We should talk. Bueno, thank you for coming.